Welcome to Lyme and Beyond with Tanya, where we talk all about Lyme and beyond, because as most of us know, Lyme rarely travels alone. I created this podcast to offer you hope and to remind you that healing is possible, because I healed from my 13-year journey. Although it was exhausting physically, emotionally, and financially, it truly was a blessing as it reshaped my mind, body, and soul. In this space, we share raw and real conversations with those who have made it to the other side of the journey, along with breaking down different topics and approaches with practitioners. My goal is to make you feel less alone, more empowered, and confident in being your own advocate. So thank you so much for tuning in today. If you're looking for more tips and resources, I share everything I learned along my journey on my LymeAndBeyondWithTanya.com website. So let's get to today's guest. I'm so excited to bring onto the show today Dr. Lindsay Wells. She's a naturopath. She's a functional medicine practitioner. And she has, not been only spending all these years helping these children and everybody in the community. She has been doing so much research, and the research that she's been diving into, and I'm going to let her go more into that because she's the doctor, not me. But it truly is about the folate receptor antibodies in vector-borne disease, PANS, PANDAS. I know that these are topics really hot in the community right now, especially in children, because oftentimes, as a parent, you might see them having, maybe just some challenging or some disabilities, or maybe the troubled child, right? Like the terrible twos that never grew out of it, when really there could be a root cause of it. And so I'm so excited to have this conversation today and just bring all this new research information and what she's discovered and her kind of approach to treating children. So, Dr. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I certainly appreciate what you do in this community because not only as adults is it hard to find practitioners, but children can be a little bit more challenging, right? Because they oftentimes can't speak for themselves, or they don't really, we as an adult oftentimes don't even know what we're feeling going through a journey like this. And to be a child and really not understand. So it takes a special person, I'm certain, to be able to do this. So I appreciate you.
Thank you.
So I know you personally haven't dealt with Lyme, but if you could just share with me and the listeners, like what got you into this world.
Sure. So when I was going through and getting my doctorate, I really loved working with children with autism. It started when I was in my rounds, and I just felt like they lit up the room. And if I spent my days with them, I would be a happy person. And, I spent the first few years of my practice working in pediatrics, and I really wanted to focus on special needs. So I started to work with my mentor, Nancy O'Hara, who her practice started to change to mainly PANS and PANDAS. So I went along for the ride there. And so my practice really has kind of shifted to PANS and PANDAS. And what I think makes us different than some of the other specialists for PANS and PANDAS is we really focused on vector-borne disease. Was that a contributor to these children? Because unfortunately, in PANS and PANDAS, Lyme disease and vector-borne disease isn't technically in the diagnostic criteria. It was removed in 2012, which might have been due more to political reasons than anything, but we kept looking for that. And we saw a significant amount of these children being infected with the vector-borne diseases. And this could have been the root of maybe why these children were susceptible to getting PANS or PANDAS. Or perhaps why treatment was stalled, why they weren't seeing the progress they were hoping to see. And so, with that, it was PANS and PANDAS, and then it really started to focus a lot in vector-borne disease because I was seeing a tremendous overlap between the two populations. So that's how I got into it. And then, I have that personally in my family with my own son and my husband as well with vector-borne disease. And so even though I haven't myself been impacted or been symptomatic from it, I do have loved ones in my household, and then also all the children that come through my practice who I absolutely love and adore as well.
Wow. And you know what? You're so right when you talk about autistic children, right? Like they just, people, I think children especially that have disabilities, They are just the happiest people in the world. Like they cannot not put a smile on your face. So I knew you were special because not everybody can work with that, right? I love that you did that. And thank you, Nancy O'Hare, for you just kind of followed in her footsteps. So it was definitely meant to be. So I certainly want to really dive into the research that you did, but actually, I want to pause for just a second for maybe listeners out there who do not even know what PANS or PANDAS is. So, right, it's a Lyme disease podcast, Lyme and beyond, we talk about because there's so many things that go beyond just the vector-borne illness, right? So if you can just take a moment and explain exactly what PANS and PANDAS is for the listeners, and then I want to dive into the research.
Sure. So PANS, it stands for Pediatric Acute Neuropsychiatric Syndromes. When PANDAS is stands for Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorders Associated with Strep. So that's just a lot of words, right? So there's the acronyms of PANS and PANDAS. Essentially, what it is, it's an acute, abrupt onset of neuropsychiatric symptoms in children. So this is, we often hear parents say, "My child, on this date changed." They know an exact date where something changed in their child. Like all of a sudden, this happy-go-lucky, carefree child all of a sudden is riddled with anxiety, starts to have OCD or tics. Something is just not right. Usually, what we see is somewhere in the history, there was some sort of an infection that came prior to the onset of the symptoms. So that could be anywhere from, a week to a few weeks to a month or more. And so essentially, it's just what's happening, an immune dysregulation causing neuroinflammation in the body and in the brain that then presents with the symptoms that we see. And so it's an abrupt acute onset of neuropsychiatric symptoms, most commonly anxiety, OCD, food restriction is a common one, unfortunately, tics, behavioral regression. We can see rage and aggression. We can see cognitive decline, and the list, urinary frequency, the list kind of goes on there, but it's really that abrupt change in your child. And parents know, they know this is not, a mental health disorder because that just doesn't come on overnight, right? Like it doesn't. Parents know something is not right with their child.
Right, you're absolutely right. And what's sad and scary is that they generally take them to their practitioner, right? And then oftentimes get told, well, they're going through this phase or they're going through this stage. And it's so easy to kind of fall into that misdiagnosis, trap that we oftentimes do. So when you mentioned earlier that there's an onset from something, whether, the root of the PANS and the PANDAS and the reason for the abrupt change, is it the same as it is in like Lyme disease or any vector-borne disease where it could lay dormant for years, decades? Is that the same in these children, or is it more likely to follow within a week or a few weeks' time frame?
It's more likely to follow probably within like 4 to 8 week time frame there.
Okay.
And so, usually we see a strep infection. That's PANDAS. That's where only strep is the trigger for that child's neuropsychiatric symptoms. But there are other triggers that can be from other bacteria like mycoplasma. Mycoplasma is a very common bacteria that school children come in contact with in the fall and the spring. It can present just with like a fever and a cough that kind of lingers a little bit, but then you see again this acute, abrupt onset weeks later. So my thinking about all of it is that there's something that predisposes these children, though, to, manifesting with PANS and PANDAS. Why is it that that child who gets a strep infection a few weeks later, they're coming on with significant anxiety and tics and OCD? So I believe that there's underlying infections that are dormant that are already causing a stress on the immune system. They then get this other infection like strep or mycoplasma or maybe another virus. And then that is kind of like what tips them over into having the manifestation of symptoms. And so, a lot of times what I think is dormant already in those children is underlying vector-borne disease or potentially mold exposure or some type of gut dysbiosis or some immune challenges of some sort. But usually there's something else there before that, like that, one infection that then tipped them into a full blown pans and pandas flare.
Gotcha. Okay. So it's interesting. It seems very similar with children, like for an adult that, maybe didn't know that they got bit by a tick. Take me, for example, right? And then we're good until we have trauma, a car accident, maybe you gave birth or a death in the family, and then that trauma, and then wow, all of a sudden, we got really sick and never got well. And so it's amazing how our bodies, they know something, right? And oftentimes our immunity can keep it under control until
Absolutely.
it can't, until it
Yes.
can't. Okay, so let's talk about, and if you can be as specific with me and the listeners, not just for the listeners, for me too, right? Like there's a lot of these terms that I don't know. So I really want to break down. So your research that you just did, I really want you kind of to give all the accolades to yourself, right? Because I think you can do a better job than I can. But I really want to know about this research that you're doing. I know that there's you and a few other people have been involved in it. And I'm just so grateful that you guys are doing this. But kind of the topic of it or the wording of it is the folate receptor antibodies in vector-borne disease or PANS and PANDAS. So, folate receptor antibodies, what does that mean?
Yes. So I'll first start with just folate. Folate is a
Okay.
B vitamin. It's B9. You've probably heard a lot about folate being discussed, especially as a woman who's in your conceiving years, or if you were pregnant, that you needed to have a prenatal with folic acid to help to prevent neural tube defects in your offspring, also to help to prevent neurodevelopmental disorders. Now, folate, we get this nutrient from our green leafy vegetables. So it's in our diet. But just like all nutrients that we get from our food, it needs to be converted in such a way in the body so that it's in the active form that the body can utilize and plug into its pathways. And so folate is needed for a lot of different pathways. It's needed for neurotransmitter synthesis. It's needed for RNA and DNA. It's needed for amino acids, for myelin sheath production. So it's a really important critical nutrient, not just when a mother is pregnant, throughout all of life. And we often hear, again, that it's in a multivitamin, but it might not be in the right form that we need it. So that's folate in general. I specifically look in my research to see if somebody is getting enough folate into their brain. And this is what's called, if somebody doesn't get enough into it, cerebral folate deficiency. It just means not enough folate in the brain. And I originally got into this area because it was something we explored with children with autism. It had a lot of research behind children with autism. It was estimated that about 71 to 75% of them can't get enough folate in the brain. And the reason
Interesting.
is they have antibodies that block the receptors on the blood-brain barrier. So you're probably like, what does that mean? So I think of receptors as locks. We have all these locks on our blood-brain barrier because it's a very tightly regulated system. And these receptors or locks have specific keys that can bind into it, unlock, and be brought into the brain. And so there can be antibodies that essentially block the ability to put the key in of methylfolate or change the receptor on it so that it's kind of disfigured and disformed. So again, you just can't get enough folate in. And in children with autism, what they found is that those kids had more speech and communication issues, more autism-like symptoms. And when you give them the treatment, which is high-dose folinic acid, there was improvements in their symptoms. So I really was invested in this, and looking at this for all of my children with autism. But as my practice changed more into PANS and PANDAS, vector-borne disease, we were still running this test to look for these autoantibodies because other research has shown that children or adults with treatment-resistant depression have these autoantibodies, not enough folate in the brain. There's some research about anxiety, research on schizophrenia, research on acute onset dementia. And think about it, a lot of those symptoms are also some of these neuropsychiatric symptoms that we see in children with PANS and PANDAS, but also vector-borne disease. And so I was really motivated because I read the study that Brian Fallon put out, where he essentially looked at mental health disorders in children, or sorry, adults with post-treatment Lyme. And just the rate of mental health disorders, the suicidal ideation, and then unfortunately the suicide was disturbing. And it was disturbing because it was too high. But also, these were people that I see in practice, that I love and adore and care for. And I saw them struggling every single day. And like, there had to be more going on than just, treating with antimicrobial herbals or antibiotics. And, so we started to look at, could this potentially be a factor, these folate receptor autoantibodies? Because we see it in depression, we see it in anxiety. We see it in learning disabilities and, dementia, which could, present with some brain fog. And then the results were quite interesting, which we just published, 2 months ago, where it showed that 61.8% of children with a confirmed vector-borne disease were positive for having these folate receptor autoantibodies.
Wow.
And then clinically, when we treated, what I see is improvement in their neuropsych symptoms, right? So it's not, I don't think it's doing anything with the infection. Perhaps maybe it is, and I don't know, but it is
Right.
helping with the symptoms, which the goal is not only to get rid of the infection, but it's really to improve the quality of life of the child and the or adult that you're working with. Like,
Yeah. No, you nailed it right there. So we're always trying to go after, sometimes people are so after like a diagnosis and this or that. But truly the first thing we kind of want to control is our symptoms, especially in children, I think, because we've got to get our body calmed down a little bit. You've got to have something a little bit more stable to kind of work with to see what's going on. This is so fascinating. I have a question that I
Sure.
want to kind of back up to the folate when you explained it and described it. So I know many of us have the MTHFR mutation, and I know that there's two genes or two snippets, or I'm not certain the exact terminology, right? And one of them is your body doesn't know how to, is it turn it into folic acid, or you can't take folic because it doesn't know how to methylate it into the folate form or something. So are you, have you done any, was there any research about the MTHFR and maybe that is part of the problem too, or some of these people, yes, they do have this mutation. Is that playing a role? Maybe it is, and then maybe it can also be completely separate.
So that's a great question because it's one of the most common questions I get, actually. So when someone has the MTHFR mutation, that means they can't metabolize folate into the bioactive form that I was describing previously. When you eat your food, it needs to be converted in such a way that the end result is methyl tetrahydrofolate. That's that key that I said could bind into the receptor and be drawn into the brain. So when somebody has the mutation, they're already at a bit of a disadvantage, okay? They also don't respond well to folic acid because folic acid is a synthetic form of folate that their body can't utilize and process the way that we would like for them to, or that it was intended for them to by adding it into foods and fortifying foods with it. But the folate receptor autoantibodies are completely different than the MTHFR mutation. So
Okay.
the MTHFR mutation is a genetic issue. The folate receptor autoantibodies are not genetic, but we do think they are hereditary, which is kind of confusing. So
Okay.
we see that it can be passed down from parents because we are seeing that parents are testing positive and also siblings. But it isn't a genetic mutation, and they're also treated differently. So, with the MTHFR mutation, often the recommendation is to use methyl tetrahydrofolate to address. And then with the folate receptor autoantibodies, the treatment is folinic acid. Now, can you have The MTHFR mutation and the folate receptor autoantibodies? Absolutely. Can you have one or the other? Yes. So, it just because you have the MTHFR mutation doesn't mean you have the folate receptor autoantibodies.
Okay.
So, you'd still want to test for that just to
Okay.
double check.
I love that. So when you say test for it, so you can actually test for the folate receptor antibodies.
Yes. And
That
so
is,
there is a blood
Dr.
test that you can
Lindsay,
do.
this is fascinating. So you just did all of this research. You've discovered what percentage was it?
61.8%.
60% of people have this going on in their body. This is huge.
Yes.
Like, this is huge, especially if you can in turn actually get a test for it,
Yes.
right? So now we can lead them, okay, you may be dealing with this, right? And
Yes.
so now let's test. How accurate are these tests? Is this a test that a normal practitioner can test for? Because we both know that the Lyme disease testing, right, is not very accurate. So
Yes.
is this something in a good way that we can get done with just our standard doctor?
Unfortunately, it can't be run through a standard lab. There's a
Okay.
specialty lab. Relligen is the company name, and you can find more information at fratnow.com. You do need a provider to order the test, but any provider could get an account and order the testing for you. It is specialty. I think it's around like $250. But it is very accurate from what we know because the gold standard for looking at the folate receptor autoantibodies is a spinal tap, which I don't know about you, but I don't know any. I think I've had like one child go through a spinal tap in my
Yeah.
practice. That was not ordered by me. It was ordered by another provider. So that's not really standard of care.
Probably a
But
hard pass for many
yes,
parents, right?
exactly. But when they compared, the blood test to the ones who also got the spinal tap, it was very comparable. So we know that this is very accurate, and we feel very confident using this test. And so it's a simple blood draw. It's one tube of blood, and the results can really, really end up changing treatment plan for somebody and has the potential to really impact, the neuropsychiatric symptoms and really help the current symptoms that you or your child are experiencing.
Wow. So when we're talking about this, we're not just talking about children that have a vector-borne illness or PANS or PANDAS. We could actually even be talking about autism,
Oh,
correct?
absolutely. That's where the
Like,
majority of the research is. Like my research is the only one in, that my research and my colleagues were the only one so far in vector-borne disease and PANS and PANDAS. There's only one, our studies on those, but the majority, like 20 plus at least in children with autism.
wow, this is so huge. Like,
Yes.
seriously, I have goosebumps because this is a type of research that we've been dying to get done, right, within this community because so much of it intertwines with vector-borne, with Lyme
Yes.
disease, and because so many times it's the root of everything. Like you
Yes.
mentioned earlier, okay, yes, you probably got infected years ago, and then because you got strep or because you got a viral infection, now all of these things are starting to pop out, but it all can go back to Lyme disease. So
Yes.
this is so amazing. And so listeners, as always, I'll put any of the relevant information in the description of this episode, including that fratnow.com, which is where they can check out this type of testing for the folate receptor
Autoantibodies.
autoantibodies. I think I
Yes.
just said antibodies earlier.
That's
That's why
okay.
I'm leaving the big words to you. That is amazing. And so this research that you've done, are we also can, is that something that we can put in the show notes
Oh,
too for
absolutely.
people?
We can link
Okay.
the
All
paper, the
right. So
published
I will
paper.
link all of that information in the notes too, because this is just truly fascinating.
Yes.
All right. So now it sounds to me that if a parent has a child going through all of these changes, right, we're not sure what's going on, that this is certainly a test that they should do or look into for their child to figure out if that is the first problem, right? The first problem allowing the other things to be a problem.
Yes.
So how does that change for somebody? So let's say we're going to work with somebody that tested and they were positive for that.
Yeah.
That is how you can more immediately address some of the main symptoms to try to calm those down. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah, so if you come back positive, it looks at two different autoantibodies, a blocking and a binding. And if any of those come back positive, then essentially what the treatment would be is folinic acid, which is a step above methyl tetrahydrofolate. But the folinic acid can utilize a different carrier transport on the brain to be shuttled in. So it can kind of bypass the receptors and the autoantibodies that are blocking those receptors. We then dose based on weight. So in the research, it's 2 milligrams per kilogram up to 50 milligrams per day. And you kind of work up to that dose. So it can take, 6 to 10 weeks to get on that full dose. But you start to see that symptoms improve. And one of the most interesting findings about the paper that I just wanted to bring up is that I said it looks for the test, the binding and the blocking autoantibody. But there's an abnormal finding, and it's called the soluble folate receptor. Essentially, what this is a protein that has a very high affinity for folate. And when this is found in this test, what we know is that those children or those people, individuals who have that, are more medically complex, which sounds like a lot of the individuals in the vector-borne disease community. And then also they may respond to higher dosing of folinic acid past that 50 milligrams per day. Now, in our
Of
research,
course, nothing's straightforward, right?
yes, no,
Nothing's cut and dry in
no.
this community.
But what we found, which was the most interesting, was that actually there was a higher percentage than we would expect to have seen with this abnormal finding of the soluble folate receptor. In the general population of who gets tested, we anticipate or we see about 5% of the population being positive. 11.8% of our population was positive for that. And the most interesting piece of that was all of them had evidence of Borrelia in there as their infection. And so I don't know what that means. Like we would have to do
I was just going
much
to say, is this
deeper
going to be your next
research.
research
I don't know.
project?
I don't know. But
I vote so.
it was just so interesting that like this abnormal finding was much higher, like over double what we would expect being in the vector-borne disease population, and that all of them had some evidence of Borrelia species in their blood. And so again, that's just a little tidbit of the research, but kind of just goes along with what we see clinically, that vector-borne disease is medically complex, and some people need higher dosing than what we see in standard, care or, children in particular. They might not respond to little pediatric dosages that we actually might need to be dosing them higher to get therapeutic benefit for them.
Gotcha. And that's an important tip to know
Yeah.
if when the test comes back, it will say, and I already
Yes.
forgot the two terms that you use. Now there's the third
Yes.
one, right? And
Yes.
so they will know that one of the biggest effects of that is your child may not respond to the normal lower doses,
Yes.
which is
Or
always good information to know.
perhaps if you haven't already explored vector-borne disease, that person should really look for underlying Borrelia species.
Right, right. Okay, perfect. So, when you are administering this for these children that have this issue, there's too many of these big words, Dr. Lindsay. I can't keep them straight. I apologize.
It's all good.
So you're treating, and this is kind of like the first step to kind of get things under control. And then I'm assuming that you do need to know if they do have an underlying vector-borne disease, right? So you know how to treat them appropriately. But can you give us an idea of, let's see, how do I want to ask this? When you do this therapy, right, and they're up to the higher dose, do you see a significant difference in lowering their symptoms to where you're almost like, okay, how much further do we need to treat, or how much do we need to dive into this? Like, what is that? We don't need to do a percentage, but kind of a ratio of how much improvement are you seeing with just addressing this specific issue?
I would have to say that this is probably what I don't love the term game changer, but it really is like one of those treatments that I have in the practice that can make a significant difference for the child. Now, do I still address the underlying infection using antimicrobials? Absolutely, because again, that's just that infection's creating a burden on their system that I need to lower so that they're more resilient when another stressor comes their way. But the number one thing is finding relief for that child and for that individual. And so this is one of the bigger treatments that I will do, and like significant improvements in, again, OCD, anxiety, brain fog, executive functioning, speech and communication. Because some of my kids will have speech disfluency, or they'll have stutters as part of like the neuroinflammation from these infections. And we get significant improvement, and then we continue to work on the underlying infection for, as you know, it's a marathon and not a sprint. It's an extremely long time to treat, but it's like they're doing better. And that's what matters. Like I always tell parents, it's important to know what's on the lab, on the piece of paper, but it's more important on how your child is feeling, right? So like if I make progress in their labs, but yet they're still not feeling well, I feel like I didn't do my job very well. If they're feeling a lot better, but the labs don't look as good as I would hope, I'm okay with that because we can continue to work and make progress. So yes, this is one of my bigger interventions in my practice where we see significant improvement and
That
relief.
is, yeah, that is amazing. And I love that you said that because truly, whether we're talking about children or adults, when we're dealing with Lyme disease, all the co-infections, it's a struggle. You mentioned it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? And a lot of times for people venturing out into whatever you want to call it, holistic, integrative medicine, that type of stuff is a really scary thing for many people, right? I know it was for me too. I'm like, you want me to do what? Like, that makes zero sense to me. But when I ran out of options through traditional Western medicine, I felt I was left with no choice, right? So this was my plan B and my last plan. And so I think that if I hadn't gone through this Lyme journey, I would probably still think it's okay just to go to the doctor and take the pill and get better. And that's how most of us were raised. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a time and place for all different types of medical providers, right? At least I feel so. But it is so much easier to go down that path if you can see some significant improvements, right? So we kind of live in a world of instant gratification, unfortunately. But I know for many, for myself, I think it would be much easier to be like, okay, I'm a month or 2 months into this, and wow, these symptoms are better, or this is better, or my child seems halfway normal now, right? Like, okay, this is the right path that we need to be on. So I love that you're seeing such a huge percentage of the children with noticeable differences just by this one thing. Like that is fabulous. And I know that we're not talking about autism, but do you know what those type of numbers are for the research that was done on the autistic children?
Yeah, so I mean, it ranged anywhere based on their symptoms, right? So, like, some of them, like 60% or more got improvements in speech and communication. Other ones, had improvements in aggression and irritability. There was other ones in stereotypy improvement, and I could, find those numbers. I don't have them on the top of my head, but like significant percentage improvements, and that there's multiple studies to show that. So that's the one thing about the autism research is it's actually documenting clinical improvements that we see with folinic acid. My papers really are only documenting right now the prevalence of it, and then all the clinical is based on improvements are based on what I'm seeing in practice, as well as my colleagues who are also looking for this and treating this. But that's next step is to then document the clinical improvements.
Right. This is truly like, I don't know if you listeners are with me right now, but like, this is huge. Like, this is so big in my eyes. And so I'm so excited for this. Amazing, amazing
Yes.
stuff. Okay. So now let's kind of take aside, all of that topic, right? Now
Yes.
let's just go back to Dr. Lindsay Wells and her practice and how she kind of approaches addressing Lyme disease, co-infections, and the things that go along with it in children.
Yes.
Do you have, I'm assuming, kind of, everybody's different. There's not one shoe that fits everyone, right? But I'm assuming that you kind of have a little bit of a step-by-step approach. And so what is your approach to
Yes.
treating children? Obviously, what
So,
you just did first,
yeah.
right? Let's test
Yes.
them.
Yeah, so I do a comprehensive evaluation, physical exam if I can, in person. I'll do something virtually as well, and then I do a lot of testing just to really know what we're dealing with, because it does change treatment plan, and I think it's very important when we're working with children that we're very targeted and individualized for them. Now, I really focus on the three-pronged approach. Now, this is something that is well documented in the PANS and PANDAS world, where we address symptom. So that's symptom support of whatever that looks at for that child. The second one is immunomodulatory support. So that's putting in a lot of anti-inflammatories, antioxidants, immune support. And then the third is putting in antimicrobials based on whatever germs, and I say that plural because most of my kids have more than one thing going on, and then addressing that. And I use antimicrobial herbals in my practice because I'm a naturopathic doctor. And so I have great success using herbals. And that will all depend based on what infection we're dealing with here. But that's
Right.
kind of, I call it my three-pronged approach. And it's not mine, Sue Sweeto termed that, but still, that's kind of what I utilize. And I feel like the most successful protocols include those three areas.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, and that makes perfect sense. So when you, again, for those that may be new to like the herbal world, right, versus antibiotics, pharmaceuticals, there's can be a lot of concern about what is safe for children, are because I'm assuming there's a lot of herbs that probably maybe not be the best choices for children versus, an adult going through that.
Yes.
Is there a lot of them that children should stay away from?
There's not a lot that I would, say to stay away from. It's more the dosing, I'm going to be honest,
Okay.
rather than the
Okay.
herb itself. And so, children are, they're not adults. So, sometimes we have these herbal products and capsules, for instance, that are really meant for adult dosing and not, pediatric dosing. And so I will really only use herbal tinctures in liquid form because I know the exact amount to use based on their weight dependent dose, and that really matters. That's where the nuance of dosing comes in. And so it should really be weight dependent. Using liquids and tinctures make it easier to get to that weight dependent dose rather than using a capsule and kind of like measuring out the powder, which is not as accurate or precise. And then there's the other component of like, what is in the tincture? Is it an alcohol extraction or is it a glycerin extraction? In my practice, all pediatric, I really use mainly glycerin in there, which is sweeter, and it doesn't contain any alcohol, which can be irritating to my sensitive nervous systems and my sensitive GI tracts, in my pediatric population. So, yes, there are different herbals. The dose matters, and I think also the preparation matters as well.
Yeah, I'm so glad I asked that because you do hear that a lot in the community. Like, we're not sure what's safe. And yes, I mean, herbals are natural, they're safe, right? But they're also powerful, they're also
Yes.
strong. You can also have counter reactions, you can also
Yes.
have all sorts of issues, like you can with pharmaceuticals. And
Yes.
I think that that's important for people to understand. It's not just, oh, it's natural, you can do whatever, you can't OD.
Right.
That really isn't the case, right? So
Right.
that's good to know that there really isn't specific ones that, are not child friendly. It's mainly the dosing of it.
Yes.
And I love tinctures because I think it's the best way to dose, right? The
Yes.
liquid, because there are sensitive people. I remember putting two drops in something and I'm like, laughing. What is 2 drops going to do, right? And so a couple of days later, I'm just going to do 10. Big mistake, right?
Yes.
So yeah, dosing using liquid tinctures, that in my eyes can be a game changer for
Yes.
many people, especially those that
Yes.
are sensitive. But so along the lines of that, I know as adults in the Lyme community, we'll do just about anything to get well, right? Or hopefully get well. We'll do lots of things. We'll drink nasty things. We'll do
Yes.
colonics. We'll do coffee enema. I mean, we'll do so much crazy stuff, right? How do you get children to take some of these
Yeah.
nasty tinctures? You've got to have some tips
Yeah.
behind the scenes that you can share with some of these
Yes.
moms out there or
Definitely. You
dads,
know,
right?
yes. I mean, you'd be surprised. I think kids know what is going to make them feel better. And so some of these kids that even have like food restriction that, you know, won't take anything, they'll open their mouth like a little bird to take the tinctures. It's so interesting. But if that is not your child,
That is very interesting.
yes. One of the best things that I have found is the use of nut butters or seed butters. They really mask the taste of bitter from the tinctures. And so we put like a little bit on a spoon and we add in the tincture that way, and then they take it off the spoon. I've also found that like putting it in the hull of a berry, like for instance, like a raspberry or something, putting it in that way can be helpful. Of course, you know, like juices, which I don't love to do a ton of them, but a small amount can be helpful. Particularly like thick juices, I think like mango juice, orange juice, actually black cherry juice works well at masking the taste. And then I also bubbly. For some reason also is helpful for getting
Like
that
a
down for kids.
carbonation
Yeah,
bubbly thing?
carbonation drink.
Okay.
So like a seltzer of some sort, kombucha, some kids will do it that way, but really the nut butters and the berries are kind of my little tricks that tend to work
Your
well for kids.
go-tos. Okay, good to know. And yes, I actually put my tinctures in orange juice, which may have been a mistake because I loved orange juice like my whole life. And I just
No.
can't drink it now because it just kind of ruined that whole thing for me. Unless, of course, you have a little champagne in it, right? Like
Yes.
I can go there. So yeah, that we definitely need these tips and tricks for children. But it's interesting that you say that there are some children out there that will just open their mouth, right? Like I
Yes.
remember having to take cold medicine as a kid. I'm like, okay, wait, mom, I've got to plug my nose, I've got to clear my
Yes.
throat, I've got to like work myself up for this. And maybe I was just one of those off children that was just really defiant when it came to doing anything that was
No.
supposed to be good for me. Wow, we have covered so much stuff. What else can we talk about? What other things are you maybe seeing in there that can be helpful to the parents that are struggling with their children? Other tips, tricks, whatever you got.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the big thing is just you know your child the best. Like, trust your intuition, trust your gut. If a doctor is not giving you the answers that you are hoping for, you know, find someone else who will listen. That's kind of like my big thing for parents. And then another thing that I think is helpful is when your child is presenting with this acute onset of symptoms, it's probably inflammatory in nature, that there's neuroinflammation happening. And the best way to kind of test that out is to use some anti-inflammatories to see if your child's symptoms get better. And if they do, that's a clue. That's a clue that it's inflammatory in nature and to push harder on the anti-inflammatories. And there are many natural ones that you can do, like for instance, curcumin or turmeric or, you know, fish oil of some sort. Hemp oil, whatever you feel comfortable with. But there's also trials that you can do with things that are over the counter, like ibuprofen, you know, that we often give to parents. Like I'll say, have you done an ibuprofen ch challenge or trial? And they'll be like, well, only if they're sick. And it's like, well, try it when, you know, they're not presenting with the acute illness, but more presenting with just this anxiety, this OCD, you know, the sleep disturbances, however it's manifesting for them. Do they get better? Because if they do, that tells us something. That tells us that this is not, you know, a mental health disorder. This is an immune disorder, and this is an inflammatory disorder. And then we push forward with that. And so I find that to be helpful for parents to be like, okay, there's something tangible I can do, and I can do this little trial. And if they're better, that gives us a clue. And we need to find then somebody who's going to listen to us and move down that pathway more. The other thing is, this is not a mental health issue. And so sometimes what we see is that putting in pharmaceuticals like SSRIs or antipsychotics can make just symptoms worse. And if that happens, that is another clue too for you. And I do find that the children, it's sometimes necessary in certain, children, but small doses, like the lower doses often works for them and helps to decrease the potential of side effects. The answer is not always to continue to increase the dose, hoping that you're going to get a different response, because in reality, you got to address the underlying infection. You got to get the inflammation down, and then you will see the improvements in the neuropsychiatric symptoms. Or perhaps they have the folate receptor autoantibodies, and that's why they're not responding to the pharmaceutical medication. And therefore, adding in high dose folinic acid could be just what you need to get those symptoms down, to make them feel more comfortable, to be happy, and like get their that carefree like childhood back for them. But it's not always a quick fix, but there's so many things out there that can help your child. And just continue to listen to your gut. You know them best, and that's really like the biggest thing that I can say. And also to take care of yourself, because your child feeds off of you. And so when you're feeling better, your child will feel better. And so those are kind of the little things that I would leave parents with.
Wow, you were on a such a roll. I had so many questions. I didn't want to interrupt you though. So that's amazing. Okay, so first of all, who would have thought? Let's do some anti-inflammatory testing on your child, right? And sometimes that can be our ammunition as a parent, to really have that more confidence in going to the practitioner saying, okay, look, right, trying to get them to understand that it is not a mental health issue with your child. And then when you talked about these pharmaceuticals for, ADD or, the different medications that they give you for anxiety and stuff. So when you say that maybe their symptoms get worse, if that really isn't the problem, what happens if the dose is upped a little bit more? Oh, well, this made him worse. So maybe we should give them more. Does that happen at all? And if it does, will it kind of reverse them back down to normal reactions or?
Sometimes what we see, at least in the PANS and PANDAS community, is that 50, about 54% of them will have more side effects from the pharmaceutical psychiatric medication. And so the recommendation is to give the lowest dose possible and to be mindful of side effects. And that perhaps instead of continuing to increase the dose, which could increase the side effects, instead try a different medication.
Okay.
And I do see that to be similar in my pediatric population with vector-borne disease as well.
Wow. This is, I mean, talk about so much information here. Like, this is incredible. I'm so excited for you, your team,
Thank you. Thank
everything that you're doing. And then for also all the parents out there that are struggling with their children to try to get answers. And it just is amazing to me how many children are struggling right now
you.
and they don't know what to do. They can't get answers and they keep going in these circles. And you may have just opened up that Pandora's box for
I
them to
hope
give them
so.
these answers. So truly, thank you so much for everything that you're doing, that you've done, and that you continue to do to help these children and in this community. You are so appreciated. And
Thank you.
listeners, again, as a reminder, as always, the information in this episode will put in the description of this episode so you can dive into it. You can know where to look for the information to get this testing. And then, Dr. Lindsay, again, you do telehealth, correct? Do
Yes,
you
I
ever
do.
have to see a patient in person or can it all be through telehealth?
I prefer to see the person
Of
in pa
course, yes.
in office, but I understand in our community that's not always possible, for a lot of different reasons. So I will see telehealth as well.
Amazing. We'll have her information in the show notes as well. Thank you so much, Dr. Lindsay Wells. I really appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.